Those voices come to you live from WKAR Studio S. 12 members of the East Lansing High School Gospel Choir, and we will hear more from these tremendous performers throughout the next hour here on WKAR's Current State. We'll also chat up director Eli Kirkland later this hour and talk about a performance that the East Lansing Gospel Choir, East Lansing High School Gospel Choir, has planned for later this month. It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. We also take a quick look at, the movies this weekend and through May and the month of June, our summer movie preview with MLive's John Serba and Current State's Emmanuel Berry. We're glad you're along here today. Yesterday, Current State learned of a brewing controversy surrounding the Lansing Marathon, which takes place this Sunday. The marathon, in its three-year existence, has not allowed disabled athletes to compete using hand cycles, which are basically three-wheeled cycles that ride low to the ground with a gear and pedal system operated by the user's hands. The marathon has, however, always allowed disabled athletes to compete using a push-rim wheelchair or a racing wheelchair. Last evening, we spoke with a hand cyclist from Houghton Lake, Michigan, Tom D'Ambrosio, who was also featured in a Lansing State Journal article in today's edition. He says he was told by Mayor Bernero recently that if the Lansing Marathon doesn't allow all people to participate, there will be no marathon in Lansing next year. We confirmed the mayor's comments with his spokesperson last night. While on the face of it, this might seem discriminating to not let Tom and other hand cyclists participate in Sunday's event, as is the case in virtually every story, there is another side. In a few minutes, we're going to talk with the founder and race director of the Lansing Marathon, Owen Anderson. We will also point out, in the interest of full disclosure, that WKAR receives underwriting support from the Lansing Marathon. But first on the line with us from Texas is Wendy Gumbert. Wendy's a coach for the U.S. Paralympic National Team in wheelchair racing and the manager of Paralympic sports for the state of Texas. Wendy, welcome to Current State.
Thank you very much.
What are your thoughts on hand cycles in marathons?
A hand cycle is equivalent to a bicycle, so it has 21-plus gears depending on the hand cycle. So a marathon is a running race. The push-rim wheelchair is equivalent to running. It has no gears. A hand cycle has gears, so it is a different device for a different sport. The sport y'all are doing in a marathon is running, not bicycling.
Well, can you describe for us a little bit more what the hand cycle looks like?
A hand cycle, it's got a crank system, and so it has a chain and it has gears. Where the push rim chair, they push it on the rims. In marathons, they do it in their day chairs, in a regular wheelchair, or they'll do it in a racing chair, which is a long three-wheeled chair. Either version, you're still propelling it only with your physical body. There's no gears assisting you to propel that chair. So therefore, it's equivalent to running, where you're running with your physical body, as opposed to a hand cycle that has the chain and the cog and the gears that change and help you to go uphill, go faster downhill, whatnot. So they're totally two different devices.
Okay. Has the issue of hand cycles in marathons been an issue at other events that you're aware of?
Yes.
What for how long?
For years. I don't know exactly
for
how
long,
but very
okay.
Very long time.
So for a long time, this is nothing new. Do the best hand cyclists in the world race in marathons or cycle races or both? Because this appears to be a part of this dispute. We've read of events that accommodate hand cyclists and others that don't.
The hand cyclists will compete in the marathons if there's the elite hand cyclists will compete in the marathons if there's prize money for the hand cycle division. I mean, anybody will do anything for money. If there's no prize money, no, you do not get the elite hand cyclists to go to the marathons. They are in cycling races. That's where the hand cycle events that are for elite are in cycling races.
Well, wouldn't you agree, though, that is at the heart of a lot of this confusion?
Right, people don't understand the difference, and that's the problem right now with the pushrim racing and the marathons, and there's too many marathons that are allowing the hand cycles in, and you get these intermediate level athletes that can go as fast as an elite pushrim. You have a gold medalist out there from the London Marathons doing the pushrim with the hand cycle finishing about the same speed as him, and that hand cyclist is just a weekend, you know, rider. But he can push about the same speed as this Olympic gold medal, Paralympic gold medalist. And they come across the line, you know, 30 seconds apart, and the audience doesn't understand the difference in the magnitude of the athleticism and what that athlete has done to accomplish what they just did by finishing a marathon in an hour and 20 minutes, where a hand cycle can finish a marathon in an hour and 20 minutes, but that's not an elite hand cyclist.
Sunday's event here in Lansing, Wendy, is sanctioned by USA Track and Field. What can you tell us about their official conditions, or what do they have to say about hand cyclists in their events?
I can't speak for USA Track and Field. Each marathon, it's their own decision whether they let them in or not. It is very important for every marathon to understand that if they do let them in, it has to be a completely separate division from the pushrim because it is completely different.
How much do your athletes who are using pushrim chairs, how much do they train for a marathon?
6 days a week, twice a day.
And what do they tend to think of hand cycles in marathons?
They hate it. It takes away from what they've worked so hard to do, because someone on a hand cycle doesn't have to train at all to do a marathon. And that's not what a marathon is about.
Well, Wendy Gumbert, we want to thank you for your insights. Wendy's a coach for the U.S. Paralympic National Team in wheelchair racing and the manager of Paralympic sports for the state of Texas. Wendy, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
We turn now to the founder and the director of the Lansing Marathon, the third of which will be held this Sunday in Lansing. Dr. Owen Anderson. Owen, welcome back to Current State.
Thank you very much, Mark. Great to be with you.
So we just heard from a U.S. Paralympic coach that hand cycles don't belong in marathons. What's your take on this?
Well, there are a couple of key issues involved, Mark. It's appropriate to bring up USA Track and Field because the Lansing Marathon is a sanctioned event by USA Track and Field. And under their regulations and guidelines, which we do have to follow, no geared devices are allowed in the competition. A hand cycle is a geared device, and therefore, if we want to follow the USA Track and Field guidelines, which we do, we want to be sanctioned, we can't allow a geared hand cycle in our event. There are also some key issues about safety. As marathon race director, I have to be extremely, even over-concerned about the safety of all participants and spectators. What people don't realize about hand cycles is that they travel at very high speeds. They're very low to the ground. They're very difficult to see. They can be out in the course traveling at 25 miles per hour or greater. If we look at our Lansing Marathon course, we have a course that is on the river trail for 40% of the miles. There are tight turns. There are blind corners. We have runners and walkers going back and forth along the same section of the river trail. Imagine a situation in which a hand cyclist would come around one of the corners on the river trail and crash into a group of runners and walkers. Suddenly people would be saying, this race director is negligent. He's reckless. He has these high-speed vehicles out on the course. So we have to operate a safe race as well. Having a hand cycle on our course is not safe. Now, that being said, we would love to work with the city of Lansing. We love Lansing. I love Mayor Bernero. We want to work carefully with the city for the future. We would love for 2015... to go ahead and set up a separate cycling event. It would have to be separate. Have to be a separate event. We would love to work on that, and we'll be glad to do it. In the meantime, we're not discriminating against any person, not at all. We simply can't allow hand cycles to be part of the event. I've invited this individual, Mr. Ambrosio, to be part of our event as a pushrim athlete. Pushrim athletes are sanctioned, are part of our sanction from USA Track and Field. They are permitted. We'd love to have him. I've invited him to participate this year and in years in the past as well. So we're not discriminating. You know, inviting someone to be in the race and discriminating are completely opposite things.
Would you agree, though? I mean, are there marathons that are sanctioned by USA Track and Field that do allow hand cyclists to participate? And if so, wouldn't you agree that that's really confusing the situation here?
Yes, I think it is. I think it is. You know, if you are following the USA track and field guidelines, you cannot allow hand cyclists to participate. So I can't really speak for these other marathons, but I would suggest that they're not following the rules of USA track and field.
We spoke with Tom D'Ambrosio, the hand cyclist who brought this issue to the mayor's attention and to ours, for that matter, and he says a push rim chair is not compatible with his physical limitations. In that light, Owen, couldn't the ban on hand cycles be viewed as potentially discriminating?
Potentially, yes, that's true, but he has not provided any documentation showing that he cannot use a push rim chair. And we always come back to the safety issue as well. These push rim vehicles are traveling at 25 to 30 miles per hour. It would be a disaster on our course, just a disaster waiting to happen. It is, when push rim cycles are involved, it is a cycling event. It's a completely different event. We'd be glad to work with the city to stage an event like that for next year, but we can't allow a cyclist to be out on our course. It wouldn't be safe.
What do you make of Mayor Brunero's comments about this being the last marathon in Lansing if you don't include everyone who wants to participate? Are you still talking and communicating with the mayor's office?
Yes, I understand what he's saying completely. We love Mayor Brunero. He's been a great leader for our city. He's been supportive of the marathon as well. We certainly want to work with him. I understand his position. We want to include Tom D'Ambrosio, but we want to include him in a safe manner that's safe for him, that's safe for all the participants. That's why I've said we'd love to work with the city and for 2015 stage a cycling event in conjunction with the marathon. We could plan a route out on City of Lansing streets, which is safe and appropriate, and we would be glad to work on that with the city and stage a separate event. But putting a high-speed cyclist in with runners and walkers, that's a disaster.
Right now, Owen, how confident are you that this dispute can be resolved and that there will be a fourth Lansing Marathon next year?
Well, we love Lansing, and we think that once all the issues are understood, we can work this out. Again, we'd love to stage an event next year, which includes hand cyclists. I think it's going to be very possible to move forward with the city. We love working with the city.
Dr. Owen Anderson is the founder and director of the Lansing Marathon. The third annual Lansing Marathon takes place this Sunday in Lansing. Owen, thank you.
Thank you very much, Mark.
Lansing High School Gospel Choir here live from Studio S at WKAR. We'll be hearing more from the choir throughout the hour and chatting up Eli Kirkland, this great group's director, here in just a few minutes and talking about an upcoming performance that they have. Thanks for joining us here on Friday on WKAR's Current State. The summer film season kicks off this week. Current State's Emmanuel Berry spoke with MLive entertainment reporter and film critic John Serba about this year's cinematic offerings. Seems like the summer season is getting started earlier than it used to.
Yeah, it's not quite the same as our actual seasons the way we see them, but Spider-Man's coming out, which means it's summer.
It's summertime.
Yes. John Serba, every year he puts out his most and least anticipated list of summer films. This year he's divided them into two parts because there's a lot of films. So we talked about what's coming out in May and June. So we have superhero films, giant robots that are crushing things, monsters crushing things, some moody and dark indie films about aliens, vampires, raunchy comedies. All of them are going to hit the big screen in the next couple months. Things to enjoy and also things to wince at. John and I started with Spider-Man 2, which is technically The Amazing Spider-Man 2.
The reboot continues. This is not to be confused with Spider-Man 2. This is The Amazing Spider-Man 2. And those of us who read comics growing up know that there is also a Spectacular Spider-Man comic and a Web of Spider-Man comic. So perhaps when these franchises get rebooted and rebooted again, we will be using different adjectives to differentiate them. It's essentially Andrew Garfield again as Spider-Man, and Mark Webb is directing it. And I'm not entirely convinced that Mark Webb is a very great action director, but he's fairly serviceable. And Emma Stone is back as Gwen Stacy. And it's the big, do you like Andrew Garfield better than Tobey Maguire debate? And whatever.
Is that a debate worth having?
Well, yeah, that's exactly my point,
guess. Another superhero film that I'm a little bit excited for is X-Men Days of Future Past. This film, it combines a cast from the prequel X-Men First Class and then also the cast from the original trilogy. So Hugh Jackman, once again, will be playing Wolverine. And at this point, he kind of is actually just Wolverine playing Hugh Jackman, in my opinion, for the rest of the time. Anyway, he's going to be central in this film because there's time travel added to the complexities of their superhero universe, and it also stars hundreds of other people. What are your thoughts?
Well, Bryan Singer, the director of the first two X-Men films, is back, and this is kind of, it feels like this is going to be the last hurrah of getting Halle Berry and Hugh Jackman and Ian McKellen and Patrick Stewart all together playing their characters. I'm really over Hugh Jackman in this role. I wish they'd recast Wolverine. This is, I think, the sixth or seventh time. I've completely lost track of it.
You can't recast him because he is Wolverine.
Oh, you can totally recast him. And I am a comic book geek going back many, many years, and he is way too tall to be playing Wolverine. I'm sorry. And I've had this axe to grind since, when did the first movie come out? 1999? 15 years I've been grinding this axe against Hugh Jackman as Wolverine. But, and so obviously he's going to be the character who's traveling back in time from the current day back to when the X-Men were a new group and led by James McAvoy playing Professor X and Michael Fassbender as Magneto. And those two actors were really good in the previous X-Men First Class film, and that's what I'm looking forward to. I'm looking forward to more of that kind of chemistry.
The next category of films coming out this summer I'd like to call Giant Things Crushing Things. So we have Godzilla and Transformers are both hitting the big screen this summer. You're looking forward to Godzilla on your most anticipated list, but not so much Transformers. All right, why a fighting dinosaur over alien robots?
I need to tell you my bias right up front. I loved the Godzilla movies, the old rubber suit Japanese Godzilla movies. I loved those as a kid. I also loved Transformers as a kid, and so I'm bringing an equal amount of nostalgia to both of these franchises. The difference is Transformers is directed by Michael Bay, who makes everything obnoxious and loud and incomprehensible. And I'm not convinced that removing Shia LaBeouf from the franchise and adding Mark Wahlberg to it is going to be necessarily an improvement. we'll see. But the Godzilla, you know, the bar is pretty low for Godzilla at this point because the last Godzilla film was the Roland Emmerich catastrophe.
Yeah.
That was so awful. And so this one, this has Bryan Cranston going bananas in every movie trailer you see for it. And it's also directed by Gareth Edwards, who a couple of years ago directed a movie called Monsters that was a low-budget indie that really made a name for him. And now Warner Brothers has given him, here's $150 million or whatever, make a Godzilla movie. And so I think there's some real potential with him because he showed some skill with Monsters and then the movie Monsters. And so hopefully he can bring a fresh angle on Godzilla.
The next film I want to talk about is another on your most anticipated list, and it's called Under the Skin, starring Scarlett Johansson as an alien.
This is directed by Jonathan Glazer, who really made a name for himself a good decade ago with a movie called Sexy Beast, which was really, really good. And he hasn't made many movies, but this one is getting a lot of buzz. It's opened up in bigger cities, and in fact, it's playing in Detroit right now, and it's slowly expanding to other markets. I get it here in Grand Rapids in a week. But the big buzz is how this is such a different role for Scarlett Johansson, and she's really stretching herself and also removing her clothing, playing this alien who is preying on men in Scotland. Typically, they're kind of derelict or hitchhikers or whatever. And I've kind of purposely not paid too much attention to hype or anything because from what I understand, the less you know, the more this movie will be effective to you. And so I've kind of purposely put a bag over my head and just said I want this movie to surprise me as much as possible. So, but you know, I do think Scarlett Johansson has the capability to carry something like this, and from all the pre-hype that I'm trying to ignore, she does. So,
a film with some local roots that also made it onto your most anticipated list is Only Lovers Left Alive. It was shot in Detroit and is partially set in Detroit, and it stars Tom Hiddleston and Tilda Swinton as vampires. We've seen a lot of vampire movies over the past 10 years or so. Is this just another vampire movie, or is it something more?
Absolutely not. You know, because, oh God, vampire movies. but this is directed by Jim Jarmusch, who you know is going to take a different angle on things. You know, he's one of the great indie auteurs of the last 20, 25 years. He did Broken Flowers and Ghost Dog and Dead Man and some other movies that tend to be fairly divisive. You love them or you hate them. And in this one, well, I think the big thing is we all know Tilda Swinton is a Class A weirdo, and so she's perfect to work with Jarmusch and play some kind of centuries-old vampire. The big key here is Tom Hiddleston. Everyone loves him as Loki in the Avengers series, and this is him. You know, can he do something else? I think it's pretty clear that he can. He's done Shakespeare, you know, but he hasn't done a lot of films that are kind of world recognized, and so he and Swinton play these centuries-old vampire lovers, and I really want to see what he can do in this type of offbeat role, in this type of unusual movie, especially alongside one of Hollywood's great eccentric actresses.
Oh, well, we also have a handful of comedies coming out this summer. On your least anticipated list, comedy-wise, we had Neighbors, which stars Zac Efron as a frat brother and Seth Rogen as a young father and annoyed neighbor of this frat house. And we also have Adam Sandler's film called Blended, and it co-stars Drew Barrymore, and it's about an African vacation, romance, funny things happening.
Theoretically funny.
Yes, yes. I mean, is this Sandler's comeback film?
No. Are you kidding me?
Have you
seen the trailer with Drew Barrymore spitting up French onion soup and Hooters? Oh, no. poor Drew Barrymore, what are you doing? And Adam Sandler riding an ostrich. Oh man. You want an axe to grind. You know, I've already talked about how I wish Hugh Jackman would give up playing Wolverine, and that's an axe I've ground for a long time, and I've ground an axe against Michael Bay's Transformers. My biggest axe is against Adam Sandler, who is the laziest person in Hollywood. Does not challenge himself with anything anymore. He does these dumb, idiotic comedies, and he keeps getting rewarded for it because Grown Ups 2 did hundreds of millions of dollars last year, and it just, oh, the world is just not a just place. But you mentioned Neighbors as well. Sorry. I was in a Donald Duck style angry rant. Red faced and breaking things. But since I wrote that piece, I've actually seen Neighbors, and it's pretty funny. So this is an instance of something from my least anticipated list surprising me. And Zac Efron, the premise is Zac Efron is a frat boy, and his fraternity moves in next door to a young couple played by Seth Rogen and Rose Byrne, who have a baby at home. And the kind of twist on it is they're a young couple who used to be the cool people, and now they want peace and quiet for their child. and they're at war with Zac Efron and the frat. And I'm probably not supposed to review it too far ahead, so that's where I'm going to stop.
You enjoyed it more than you thought you would.
Absolutely, absolutely. There is a part of me that as a snooty film critic, am I supposed to like this? Well, no, but you laugh anyway, in spite of yourself. and that's kind of why I'm also looking forward to 22 Jump Street.
Yeah, I was about to say that's on your most anticipated list.
I really enjoyed 21 Jump Street, and partly because Channing Tatum, who knew he could be funny? You put him on the screen doing funny stuff, and he's pretty good, you know, especially with Jonah Hill, and they had some chemistry. And the first one, actually, the action scenes were fairly well-directed. You didn't expect that. You know, there was some kind of exhilaration going on in this car chase. And like, what am I really watching a comedy riff on a corny old TV show? I mean, what? I didn't expect to like that. And so, you know, the same team is back together. We'll see if they can capture lightning in a bottle again this summer.
This, of course, is just a sample of the films coming out in May and June. John, we'll talk with you again when the second part of your summer film preview comes out.
Yes, we have July and August to look forward to. It never ends.
Yes. As always, it's a pleasure.
Thank you.
John Serba is a film critic and entertainment reporter for MLive and the Grand Rapids Press. For Current State, I'm Emmanuel Berry.
The East Lansing High School Gospel Choir here on WKAR's Current State, 12 members strong under the direction of Eli Kirkland. We'll talk with Eli in a bit and hear more from the group. before our hour is through. You're tuned to Current State here on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Michigan has just over 13,000 children in its foster care system. Most are living in licensed homes, but many live with relatives who are either licensed or unlicensed to provide care. Still others are in child-caring institutions. May is National Foster Care Month, and as part of that observance, one Mid-Michigan agency is sponsoring an exhibition of artwork made by foster care children in search of adoption. Joining me in the studio today, Tamara Johnson. Tamara's the Community Relations and Marketing Director for St. Vincent Catholic Charities. Welcome, Tamara.
Thank you.
Also with us, Whitney Banks, the agency's adoption recruiter. Welcome to Current State.
Hi, thank you for having us.
Whitney, in general, who are these kids? What circumstances have brought them to you at St. Vincent Catholic Charities?
These children are mostly kids that have been abused, have experienced all forms of abuse and neglect. These kids come from situations such as physical abuse, emotional and sexual abuse, as well as having severe long-term neglect.
How many kids are under your purview right now at St. Vincent?
The kids that I serve a small number of children, which is 10, because I travel the state of Michigan visiting these children. They're not local. They're everywhere. And I visit them once a month, and I help prepare them for adoption as well as prepare families that I found that could be a suitable match for these kids.
Okay. And you're officially, your title is adoption recruiter. What does that mean?
That means is that I have a smaller caseload where I work with children with various agencies. I service St. Vincent, but I also service other agencies as well with their kids. Particularly what we do is that our kids that have been in the system for a very long period of time, especially our teenagers, they are the ones who receive this service. So if a worker feels as if like, okay, we need an extra service to help find these kids' families, they will make a referral to our program, and then I will go out and I can help them come up with a recruitment plan to help this child gain permanency.
Recently, our Kevin Lavery here at Current State visited with a few of the young people in the foster care system. He wanted to learn a little more about them and help give voice to their concerns. We're going to hear now from Bryce. Bryce is 16 years old. For proprietary reasons, we're not giving Bryce's last name, but Bryce talked about how he came into foster care. Let's listen.
Long story, but my parents did something they shouldn't have done. So that happened. The state had to take me. Yeah.
How long ago was that?
I'm 16. I was 4 when I took her away. So about 12 years.
So you've been in foster care since then?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What does that feel like?
It's difficult because there's so many kids that you meet that have the same problem and they're looking just for the same thing that you're looking for. It's difficult to know that not everyone's going to be able to get one family.
What are you looking for? I know it's a big question.
Well, I don't know exactly, but I know I'm looking for a family who's caring and who wants to know about me and learn more.
What would you want people to know about you? Who is Bryce?
He's very creative. He likes to play video games, go outside. He loves soccer. He's a twin, which is very important.
You've got some artwork here. What are we looking at here?
Just a kind of a collage. I just found certain things that I like out of magazines that represent art to me. First, I have like all these metal scraps of letters, and they're just randomly placed in areas. I like that. And this last one is a robot. I don't know exactly what it is, but I like just the shape of it.
And you've got the words "Golden Genius" toward the bottom. Does that mean anything?
Yeah, I'm really smart. I like to. I'm clever in finding ways to get out of things. You have to get out of situations.
Everybody has their gifts, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, everyone does.
Well, that was Bryce, who was served by St. Vincent Catholic Charities here in Lansing. And we're talking with our guests, Whitney Banks and Tamara. Let's turn to you. What we just heard from Bryce.
Right.
What are we learning in Michigan about foster kids' outcomes?
Well, I think we would hope that we're actually making some progress in placing these children into homes. You know, the state of Michigan has been very active in making sure that these children have the support that they need. They have extended the foster care age. They did that back in 2012 from 18 to 21 if children do make that decision to stay in the system. And so what we're trying to do is make sure those support systems are there for them moving forward. And currently the kids that are in care, you know, there's a lot of resources available. I think St. Vincent Catholic Charities is a perfect example. You know, we have a psychiatrist on staff that's available to our children. We have very loving and caring case managers, people with positions like Whitney's, who's actively out there pursuing families for these children.
Whitney, what have we learned anything important since 2011, since the age was raised from 18 to 21?
In my opinion, yes. Because
what have we learned?
I feel like we have learned that even though these kids are 18 and by law they're considered as adults, but really they really have not learned how to navigate this world just yet, because some of them have not had good examples of what it's like to really navigate the actual adult world. So by them still staying in the system, they still have support, they still have resources, and they have people who they identified as people that have healthy relationships, you know, in order for them to succeed in this world. Now, it's not ideal because they're not coming from a typical family if they age out of foster care, because some of our kids do go to independent living programs, which is institutional programs that help children gain that support to live out on their own. And that's not your ideal family where you have a mom or a dad or some type of support system to kind of show you how to live on your own. So they have a different perspective. And by them staying in our care, at least these kids can feel somewhat safe. They feel like, okay, you just didn't kick me out and put me on the street and have me to, you know, fend for myself. At least I have something. And with the state, our children are eligible to go to college for free. They get a free college education. They have, for instance, MSU, they have FAME, which is for foster children who are in the system. Other universities, they have these programs as well. They help cater to these kids. So it just took people to take a stand saying, hey, we shouldn't just stop at 18 because of these kids' situation. We need to continue to help them.
Some of these kids are in their late teens. Mm-hmm. They're reaching an age when they might be overlooked by people considering mm-hmm. adoption.
Yes.
How does that play out here in 2014?
You know, it's the reality of adoption is the older you are, the harder it is for a teenager to become adopted. It is the reality of it because parents, they have their own fears. And the most common thing that I hear from families is, oh, what if I can't mold them to be what I want them to be? I can't change them. What if they go back to their birth parents? Or what if they're just using our family just as a place to kind of like just wait till they age out and they can go off and do their own thing? But it's quite interesting working with these young people is that they want to change. Mm. They don't want to stay in the same, you know, situation that they're in. They want to have that loving person to help them. And I am on my soapbox right now, and I know that. But I say, regardless if you're 16, 17, or 18, you're still a child. They're still kids, and they need to have that guidance.
Tamara, there's an art exhibit coming up Sunday at Absolute Gallery in Lansing. Tell us about that.
Right. We are going to be having an adoption art exhibit where the kids actually created vision boards with the theme In Our Voices. And so these boards are really showing who the children are, you know, what they want out of a family. As Bryce spoke about, what things that they feel like highlight their personal interest and things like that. So that's going to be Sunday, May 4th. 2 p.m. is the start of the program. Whitney is going to allow the kids to actually stand up and present their artwork. So you want to make sure you don't miss that.
Tamara Johnson is the Community Relations and Marketing Director for St. Vincent Catholic Charities in Lansing, and Whitney Banks is the agency's adoption recruiter. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you very much.
Earlier in this interview, you heard from a young man named Bryce. We have one more conversation for you to hear now. Current State's Kevin Lavery, again, spoke with a budding young poet. Tashiana is 16 years old. Here she is reciting her work, Generation.
How God created us, He formed us in many different ways. Some people came out smart, some people came out brave. All of us are different, we will never be the same. So now that our generation is gone, the world in today's society has changed. Sometimes I wonder how our ancestors were really made. Now that I realize, life has faded away. I never figured how hard it would be to see a horrible place not setting my family free. I had to look upon the things they did for me. I had to speak the word of justice for history. I want to speak the truth. I want to speak for peace. I want to say I love you even though we never spoke. If you are far away, so high up in the sky, I will never forget you. This is my time to say goodbye.
Tashiana, what do you want for yourself?
I want bonding, good relationships, and I just want to be happy. Because in today's society, people need homes. Like, seriously, people need homes. Like, without homes, they will be on the streets selling anything or doing anything to get what they need. So I feel like in life, children and teens, basically, period, everybody needs a home and someone to call family.
You're listening to Current State on 90.5 WKAR East Lansing. I'm Mark Bayshore. Commencement season is upon us. MSU is sending new graduates out into the world this weekend here in East Lansing. The only thing more ubiquitous than caps, gowns, and cameras is a military march written by a British composer in 1901. Seriously, why do Americans graduate to a tune that across the Atlantic Ocean essentially has become an unofficial English national anthem? Current State's Melissa Benmark joins us to talk about the song that's helped commence graduates for over a century.
Okay, so Mark, we have a little time to talk here because this part of the Pomp and Circumstance March number 1 almost never gets played at graduation, so we have a little time before we get to the familiar part. Oh, take your time.
Okay, so who wrote the graduation song?
Edward Elgar, 1857 to 1934, self-taught composer in England. Around 1900-ish, he bemoaned the lack of stirring military music and started writing some pieces that were pretty much meant to be marched to. This is the first one.
And can you put those words, pomp and circumstance, into context for us?
Well, he took the title from Shakespeare's Othello. Actually, you want me to do the Shakespeare thing here?
Oh, Dame Benmark, by all means.
Oh, boy. Farewell the neighing steed and the shrill trump, the spirit-stirring drum, the ear-piercing fife, the royal banner, and all quality, pride, pomp, and circumstance of glorious war. So the pride and pomp, of course, the glamorous part, I guess, and then the circumstance being the actual war.
How did it get popular?
Well, this one and the Pomp and Circumstance number 2 were played at the London Proms concert in October of 1901. The Proms are these annual summer concerts that have gone on in London since the mid-1800s. And accounts of the premiere say that the audience actually stood up and yelled. It was the one and only time in the history of the prom concerts that an orchestral item was accorded a double encore.
Hmm.
And so it now gets performed at the last night of the BBC Proms concert every year. Well, then King Edward VII thought it was so cool that it should have words, so Elgar got the poet A.C. Benson to write some later on. And now you have the song Land of Hope and Glory, which really is, to this day, sort of an unofficial British national anthem, although some detractors say it's a glorification of imperialism. At any rate, the association people have with this music in Great Britain and in America is totally different.
So how does it get from the Proms in 1901 to Breslin Center in 2014?
Well, the Buddy Way, a buddy of Elgar's at Yale, was responsible for Pomp and Circumstance's coming to America. Professor of Music Samuel Sanford invited Elgar to come to the U.S. and get an honorary degree in June of 1905. And as the graduates and officials were marching out, the Pomp and Circumstance March No. 1 was played, and the audience loved it. And other prestigious American universities started to use it at their graduations, Princeton in 1907, Chicago in 1908, Columbia 1913, Vassar 1916, Rutgers 1918, and the rest, as they say, is music history.
It's become a tradition, certainly, but is there still any meaning invested in it?
Well, you know, in kind of a strange way that I guess only an Elgar geek would know, one big thing that students of all ages take with them from their time in school is the great friendships that they've made, some of which, you know, last the rest of their lives. So it's kind of cool that Elgar was really big into dedicating pieces of music to his friends, including all 6 Pomp and Circumstance marches. This particular one was in honor of his friend Alfred Rodewald, who was an amateur conductor in Liverpool.
Melissa Benmark, thanks for joining us, and congratulations to all the 2014 graduates who will be marching slowly and proudly to this song sometime in the very near future. Thanks, Melissa.
Thanks, Mark.
It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Thanks for joining us here on Friday. I'm Mark Bayshore. Let's go now to our featured live performers here in Studio S on Current State. We're hearing today from members of the East Lansing High School Gospel Choir, directed by Eli Kirkland. Right now, the choir performs He's Able. Members of the East Lansing High School Gospel Choir here on Current State under the direction of Eli Kirkland. The performers today, Jordan McCain, Janiah Luckett, Ernest Luckett, Ruthie Musa, Amia Everett, Jayla Ash Shakur, Cherished Kirkland, Kamira Rogers, Johnny Kirkland, Nick Stevens, Ivana Amory, and Nyla Kirkland. Did I get those all right?
Except Adjani Kirkland.
Adjani Kirkland.
Adjani
Kirkland.
Yes, sir.
Oh, heck, I thought I got all the way through it.
You good.
Hey, Eli, when did this choir get started?
Well, because this is so near and dear to my heart, I remember the exact date and the exact time. It started September the 27th, 2012.
Okay, and what role did you have in the formation of the choir?
The director, me and this other gentleman named C.J. McClendon, and he had more of a director lead last year, but we just worked together and tried to put it together. We started off with 3 people and then ended up with over 30 people in a choir. So,
and we've got a dozen here today. You've still got how many total members do you have?
Around 25, 30.
Okay. And is the group open to everybody?
Everybody.
Okay. Now, I understand you typically don't have a spring concert. Why did you decide to have one this year?
Well, we've always wanted to have one, but I made it happen, really wanted to make it happen because this is my last year doing the choir as I'm graduating this year and won't be here in Michigan any longer. So I really wanted to make it happen so that we can leave out with a big bang.
So you are the student director
of this
choir. We want to make that clear.
Yes, sir.
Gospel music isn't always what comes to mind when most people think of young people and music in general. Mm-hmm. What is it about the style of gospel, a vocal gospel music, that really resonates with you and your group?
Well, restate that question, please.
What is it about gospel vocal music that just really grabs you, really resonates with you?
The anointing. I mean, there's a certain feeling that you feel when you sing gospel music that you don't feel with any other type of music. There's a certain feeling of, you know, peace and love. There's something in the words and in the beat and the song. It's something that's not in any other kind of music, and it's called the anointing.
The anointing.
The anointing.
Tell us when your concert is.
May 31st, 2014, at the Tabernacle of David in Lansing, Michigan. The address, actually, you know what? We prepared for this question.
You're right. When is the concert?
Choir, when is the concert? Say, our
concert is coming on Saturday night. We hope to see you at 7 p.m. It's at the Tabernacle of David, and it's on the 31st. So let's celebrate, because he is good to us.
What we gonna do, y'all? We go.
So let's celebrate, because he is good to us.
I don't think they heard it. Say it one more time. Let's celebrate.
So let's celebrate, because he is good to us.
The East Lansing High School Gospel Choir, see them and special guests Saturday night, May 31st, 7 p.m. at the Tabernacle of David on West Holmes Road in Lansing. We want to thank Eli Kirkland and all of the other performers.
Problem.
Thank you, Eli.
Thank you.
You made it really special here today. You're gonna sing us out here in just a minute. I'll remind our listeners that next week on Current State, we'll learn about Michigan's new fracking regulations, also live ukulele music for Mighty Uke Day, that and more next week on Current State. That's our show for today. More from the East Lansing High School Gospel Choir. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.
I'm chasing after you.